I don't even do drills for the sake of doing drills, because there's nothing that substitutes the actual gymnastics.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Shift Show, where my number one goal is to give you the tools, ideas, and the latest science to help you change gymnasts' lives. Today on the podcast, very excited to have on Will Banthorpe, who is a fantastic coach out in the UK in men's gymnastics, and really wanted to pick his brain on high bar things. This is a very popularly requested topic around release moves and dismounts and how to develop these things safely in a way that doesn't develop any anxiety or fear for a young male gymnast. I mean, I can speak from experience in saying that dismounts for me were terrifying because I did not really have a good foundation and technical development to go off of. And so a couple close calls where I hit my shins on the bar and then I started pinging them out all the way. And so I know a lot of people ask me about dismounts and fear and mental blocks. And so Will has some really fantastic pieces of advice here around how do we develop these in a safe way? How do we make sure the drills and the skill progressions match? And then also, when do we know if someone's ready, right, to actually start doing the full Tkachev skill or the full release skill or dismount? Or when do we know if it's ready to go in a routine, which a lot of these, you know, murky areas are sometimes tough for young coaches to know. And so Will has so much experience teaching these at a very high level and having many athletes who've competed them at a high level. So this is a really great opportunity for us to kind of pick his brain and learn from him. And of course, on the heels of this is that Will's being announced as doing a fantastic high bar lecture for the Shift Symposium. And so if anybody wants to really dig in and see the drills, the progressions, exactly the technical foundations that, you know, he uses to be successful, that's going to be a fantastic lecture. We have a stocked lineup on the men's gymnastics side and the women's gymnastics side, but we have an epic lineup of that day too. So I'm really excited to share that with everybody. So if you want to check out the symposium, it's www.shiftmovementscience.com/2023 Shift Symposium, and tickets are closing soon. So make sure you jump on that. But if you just want to enjoy the episode, that'd be great too. Just go ahead and like, and subscribe on iTunes or Spotify, ping us on DMs or ping us on Twitter and let us know what you enjoyed. You know, if you want clarification, Will's really open to, you know, give you more tips if you're looking for some drills or progressions that he mentions during the podcast. So hope you all enjoy this wonderful podcast with Will. Will, my friend, how are you? It's good to finally connect.
Yeah, fantastic. Very well. Thank you. Yes, it's been a long time coming, but yeah, it's really good to finally be in touch.
I know. I'm so lucky that I have a lot of connections in the men's gymnastics world, you know, like Luke and other people that by proxy, you start to get connected to more people. And you were on the list of things eventually I needed to get to and talk to. So it worked out well that you could hop on.
Yeah. It's really exciting. I'm a big fan of the podcast. Listen to it quite regularly. So great job. Really excited to actually be part of one myself.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm very lucky and I think I'm spoiled, right? I can use the podcast as an excuse to learn and talk with people. So if I can do that in a way that helps other people, then why not, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
And there's so many, man, the more I do this, there are so many smart, wonderful humans working in gymnastics on the coaching side. And I feel like the podcast has become successful because it's bringing to light people who are in the trenches like you that, you know, you don't really have time to create a podcast and, you know, put together your lecture material. But I feel like we can harvest so much information from people with you with so much experience, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's, like you said, there's so many people that you could just learn infinitely from. So it's great just to share with other people and to take on board what others offer as well. And it's just all one massive learning curve and it benefits everybody. So yeah, super exciting.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, I'm not sure your age, I'm not going to ask, but I feel like in our age, we grew up in the internet boom too, as well. Whereas it used to be, you had to fly across the country and pay to get in a clinic and then scribble a bunch of notes, you know, and those are great. I still love those, but I feel like the internet and the podcast and things like that have allowed, you know, in a 10 years ago world, you know how hard it would be for me and you to connect, for me to go to somewhere in the UK and meet up with you and do a clinic, but we could just chat here. I think it's awesome, you know?
Absolutely. It'd be virtually impossible, wouldn't it? I mean, like we've got endless connections now to pretty much anybody in the world. So it's, real thankful for the technology.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess before we dive into, you know, the specifics of some things you're going to talk about is I would love for you to just maybe give a high level overview of, you know, your kind of journey in gymnastics and how you got to where you are being, you know, in a position where a lot of great, you know, great guys are coming out of your gym and stuff like that. So maybe just start there.
Yeah. Okay. So, interestingly, I was never really a gymnast myself, which is, you know, I think it has its pros and its cons, but, my story is kind of my brother and sister. Well, my two brothers and my sister were all involved in gymnastics. They're all younger than me. They started consequently when they were younger. And basically I was really no good at doing gymnastics and kind of enjoyed being around in the gym and sort of figured out that I was actually better at helping others do it than doing it myself. Yeah, that's how I got into gymnastics. It was a little bit of a strange one from compared to, you know, some sort of former athlete. And then so that was what age, about 12 maybe. Kind of started coaching low level recreational gymnastics when I was about 13. Did a good few years of low level rec gymnastics. Just really loved the vibe of elite gymnastics and particular men. So kind of got involved volunteering and helping out alongside those. And that sort of grew into a passion, really, and it sort of went from one strength to the next. Kind of went from a volunteer to a paid coach, and then kind of become a head coach of the sort of head of the department for the men, kind of managing the men's program. And then, yeah, kind of going on sort of up towards higher level, winning national medals, sort of producing international athletes, and then, you know, then on to Europeans and world. So, it, yeah, it just kind of spiraled, really.
You make it sound so easy, Will. you just start coaching, you do rec, and then you have international medals. But no, yeah. So I know for a fact there is a crazy amount of work and personal development and self-reflection that probably goes into that. So are there things that you notice in yourself and your journey, but also you're connected with so many other great coaches where you are there patterns or trends that you notice that help you go from that, you know, I'm a recreational, I love this, but I really want to ascend the levels up. Are there like key elements or pieces of advice that you could give people to kind of share on that journey?
I think ultimately, you kind of said it earlier, that the information is out there, and particularly with technology as it is now, we are open to connection. So it's just about putting yourself out there, seeking out the right people. There's so many people, so many fantastic people you meet that I've met that are so happy to help and assist and give advice and offer support. Mm. You just have to seek it out. I mean, my biggest piece of advice would be don't just sit there and wait to be spoon-fed. You know, you've got to put yourself out and be keen to do that. And if you go out and look for it, there's unlimited amounts of information and support out there.
Yeah, and I find for sure, I think the perception sometimes in gymnastics, particularly elite gymnastics, is that everyone's hiding their secrets and they want a competitive advantage, they don't want to share. But I find the opposite is very true. I find that in gymnastics as a whole, in women's gymnastics, and even in men's gymnastics, that like most people are willing to share, and kind of the rising tide lifts all boats. And even between countries, I feel like there's this kind of like, you know, we don't want to share our secrets with other countries and federations. But I really have never found that to be true, you know, and a very small set of people who are maybe closed-minded. But for most people, 95% of the people want to learn from you, you know, make bonds, make lifelong coaching journeys. Like, I find that's true. Is that true for you as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. I mean, you know, it might be you have to kind of get to know somebody and sort of get into their sort of trusted circle a little bit before they start sharing their deepest and darkest secrets and tips with you. But yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, if anybody ever emails me, well, message me on Instagram or anything and ask for help or advice, I'm more than happy to do it, because, you know, at the end of the day, I love gymnastics. I love what I do. If it's helping some, and, you know, helping other coaches and other athletes is a big part of what brings the love of gymnastics to me as well.
Yeah. And to that point, I think that, you know, everyone's a little bit cautious at first because there's so many people probably trying to connect with each other. But if you approach that situation and you can genuinely give the idea that you just want to help, you just want to learn, you're not in it for the money, you're not in it for the medals or the status. Like, if you enter the relationship, you know, thinking about money or scores or stuff, people can smell that and it kind of gives a bad vibe. But if you go and just generally, I want to find ways to help my athletes and help myself be happier as a coach, I think most people are super receptive, because we all started from a position where we knew nothing and we had to learn from someone, right?
100%, and it's about, like you say, striking up a conversation, and it's two way, isn't it? I think I would never feel that I can't learn from anybody else what they can learn from me as well. So yeah, it's absolutely two way conversation, really.
Yeah, and I think now, kind of like as you are now in a pretty successful coaching position, is, are there things that you're doing more on the daily basis, like whether it's personal development or whether it's like interacting with the guys, like that you feel helps maintain that environment of, you know, healthy and progressing towards high level goals, but doesn't get monotonous or burnout or all that kind of stuff? Do you find there's things you find yourself doing every day to keep that up?
I'm constantly looking on Instagram and YouTube and just trying to find new ideas, fresh ideas. And it's about, you know, again, all to do with the advances in technology. We know what everybody else in the world is doing. Sure. If you'd have taken it back 20 years, you would have to wait until you're a Europeans or a world before you see what somebody in China or Japan or America is competing. But now, literally, as soon as somebody achieves a new skill, the world knows about it.
Mm.
So it's, you know, it's just about keeping current as well. I think as soon as you, as soon as we stop being current, as soon as we stop in our track, then we are going to struggle and we're going to stop learning and we're going to stop progressing to the extent that we need to be.
Right. Yeah. And I find in particular, I think that that explosion of knowledge came quite a bit in like the 90s, 2000s, when the internet came for drills and progressions and technique. And I find now that for a lot of that stuff, it's well known. I think for more, I see so much change happening on, you know, mental health, nutrition, physical preparation, culture. Like, that's what I think. I think we're in like the Renaissance era of really collaborative discipline work and having, you know, I think about, you know, the team with a Canadian, you know, national team, sometimes like Ellie Black and Dave, and those people are Luke and Reese. Like, you can see all the people they're working with and what they're learning from everybody, which I think is amazing, right? Whereas like in the 80s and 90s, it was like a coach and an athlete and barrel head. You know, I think we have so much more information.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's all about the bigger picture now. And like you say, the preps and the drills, they're quite readily available. And that will get you 90% of the way. But now we're looking for that last 10%, and it might be 1% from here, 2% from there, you know, and how to keep our athletes happy and keep their well-being at the forefront, you know. And it's been a great thing to have all of the stuff that's come out about the athlete well-being. It's incredibly important. So I think, you know, now more so than ever, like you say, it's seeking the bigger picture and trying to get those last few percent and trying to make things sustainable, really.
Sure. Yeah. And I also find that the farther I got into my coaching career, I realized how many plates coaches were juggling, right? You were trying to think about mental health. You were trying to think about physical preparation, then the technical stuff. Then there's parents. Then there's so many pieces of being a coach that I took for granted. And the deeper I got, the more I realized I kind of need the help of other experts, because each of those things is a full-time career, right? Like, to be, you know, avid in strength conditioning and avid in nutrition and avid in mental health, it's impossible for a coach to do all that and still technically be developed. So with so much information coming out, I love the fact that more people are leaning on experts who are in the sport and are trusted and love it, you know, and they complement those skill sets that maybe you don't have the time to spend on.
Absolutely. And even to the extent where you would look outside of the sport of gymnastics, you know, right, and go to, you know, weightlifting or, you know, strength and conditioning and utilizing stuff. If they do it so well in their sport, why can we not utilize that and expand and broaden our thoughts of gymnastics into these other areas that have been doing that solely for years?
I couldn't agree more, right? That's one of the most exciting things for me is you look at research on what things have an enormous amount of support to from other Olympic athletes or other federations to dramatically increase performance long-term, but also reduce the risk of injury and keep someone healthy. Like, hybrid models of strength conditioning are really, you know, solid. And I'm really excited that the last 10 years we've seen the slow drip feed of like, okay, a lot of that stuff maybe is not the most useful for gymnastics, but there is a lot of stuff that really is. And that's really exciting to see, is because I think there's so many opportunities there, you know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, connecting to these different sports and just taking on board the models that they've tried and tested for decades, perhaps, and you know, the areas that they are absolute experts in. Why try and reinvent the wheel when it's already there? And, you know, they've done the groundwork. We can utilize it and tweak it and adapt it and apply it to what we need it for. Not saying it will be exactly 100% the same and we're not going to copy everything, but, you know, taking the relevant part and adapting it to what we need and make it work for gymnastics is a no-brainer, really, to me.
Yeah. And kind of on this idea of collaboration and kind of constantly learning is, you know, I definitely want to pivot and chat a little bit about HIBAR, because obviously that's something you're going to give a phenomenal lecture on that I've seen. But, you know, for me personally, I feel like as a younger gymnast reflecting back, I was thinking a lot last night about this podcast. Dude, I was terrified of HIBAR. Like, terrified, right? Like I learned, I it's my fault. I didn't put enough discipline into basics and technical development and stuff like that. But I remember just like every time we had a dismount, you know, day or learning Chinese taps, I was just like hiding in the bathroom and I did not want to do it. So I'd like to maybe start there, because I think, disagree if you think, but like, I think HIBAR is the most mentally fear-driven event that a lot of young men deal with. And I would love to hear your thoughts on maybe approaching that.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. It's a scary apparatus. And I think you have to, as a coach, be very delicate on your way around negotiating. Gymnasts that do show that fear aspect, because they are a good number. I mean, for me, my key principle that I touch on in the lecture is feeling support through the bar. Mm. And by that, I mean, if you imagine a long swing that's going around the bar, when your long swing reaches handstand, it's almost like bouncing in the handstand position and showing a support. And for me, this is absolutely key, because from that, the gymnast can then create the times, and they can choose the times, rather than if you skip over the handstand, the time just kind of happens to you. And at that point, you are then a passenger rather than the driver of your high bar routine, your dismount, or whichever you're doing. So for me, you know, feeling support and then choosing when and where the action happens puts you in the driving seat, and therefore gives you a lot more confidence in your bar routine, because you're actually choosing what's happening to you rather than, you know, just ending up wherever you go.
Yeah. And I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, again, you're the expert, but I feel like high bar, more than any other apparatus, maybe like tumble track, is the technical errors, or maybe the not polished basics, are magnified dramatically, right? So when you start to not have the best tap timing, or maybe you have a shoulder angle, when you start to tap harder and you start to really do a lot more bounce in the bar, it sends you much more aggressively. In the same way that if someone has technical errors in their tumbling technique, when they go to tumble track, those are magnified when they shoot right, when they early twist or stuff. And for me, that always felt like the sea was, like, I never really learned proper tapping into a dismount. And so the farther I got along the ladder of trying double backs or trying to do twisting, it got magnified where I was kicking them out farther and farther. And once that train leaves the station, you know, it's really hard to go back and redo it.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I think you're exactly right. Dismounts tend to be the most scary thing. And I always say to all the little gymnasts that I coach, I think learning a straight back dismount off a pie bar or a flyaway dismount off pie bar is the single most scary thing in gymnastics that you learn. Mm. And I always say to coaches as well, they need to take the utmost time and care over that. Not just in teaching it technically correctly, but in protecting the gymnast to make sure that they don't have any scary experiences whilst they are learning it. Because those scary experiences, if they do come back to the bar, if they do scare themselves, that, you know, it can set them back weeks or months of training. They can be at the point where they're really confident and really happy to do it. They do one bad go, and that's months of work, you know, down the pan, just because the coach perhaps was a little bit too excited, or, you know, it's natural, you want to push the gymnast on, but you know, it's really, really important just to take the time and to ensure that things are done really, really well and properly, and set that grounding in place, because, like you say, it's such a, you know, without that basic, you cannot do any other dismount on bar. If that's inconsistent, your dismount's inconsistent forever, and therefore it's scary.
Yeah, I can tell from vivid experience, it takes one shin to bar layout to really ruin your experience with dismounts in general. that was what happened to me. And I love that you said that, which is, you know, really kind of watching out and going slow and taking care of the athletes. And I feel as though a lot of younger coaches are watching other athletes develop, whether it's release moves or whether it's dismounts or it's in bars, right? And they feel pressure that they want to go and get the next thing because season's coming up and they have to have these elements and they have to have this score. And I find that sometimes that pressure of competition or levels causes them to maybe not skip steps, but rush through really going slow on tapping. And then it leads to a situation where you get to a meet, the adrenaline's high, you tap a little early, and then whoosh, you're right in the bar and you duff it on a pretty high stage. And then you can, like you said, you're set back multiple months. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, 100%. And especially if it happens in competition on a big stage, because it's not just then your shin that hurts, it's your pride and your self-esteem and everything that takes a massive beating as well. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would 100% always prefer to see a gymnast competing clean, safe routine that are slightly at a lower level. I have a philosophy where my gymnasts always try to compete at sort of 75-80% of what they're training, because, you know, that last 25% of stuff, the top 25% of skills that they're learning, they are learning still. They're not, I wouldn't say they're consolidated. Yes, they could probably do them in a competition situation,
right?
But you add in the adrenaline, you add in the pressure, and, you know, it starts to, the odds start to go down. They start to stack up against you. So I always say, you know, 75% of what you can train in the gym is what I would be happy with putting in my routine.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. I love that. And when you're teaching that foundation, well, I guess we'll start with some of the basic stuff and work our way up to, you know, some pretty high level release stuff. Is, are there certain like drills, like you said, I think a straight back is probably like the most important thing they learn. Is that from a tap swing for you? Do you do that from giants first? Like, how do you approach that?
I would do that from like holding the gymnast in like a front support position on top of the bar and just do it just from swing. And it's swing to tap swing to upside down to stop them in like a candlestick, drop into the pit, and just hundreds and hundreds of those until they're doing it and without questioning me. When they can stop, you can look at a gymnast and you can see when they're scared. When you tell them, right, today we're going to do dismounts on bar, if they look at you with their eyes wide and look like they're nervous, they have not done enough of them. If you tell them, right, tap swings on bar, and they say, oh yeah, brilliant, can I turn it? Then you know you're getting towards that gymnast confident and you should be at the level where you can be considering moving on. But I think whilst they're scared, whilst they're looking at you and with those terrified eyes, then 100% we should not be moving them on.
Sure. Yeah. And definitely a big credit to my coach who was, gave me tough love when, you know, I was not quite ready to move on. As though my 12-year-old defiant self said I was ready. I was locally just more like you said, it's a pride thing. It's like all my teammates are doing double backs and I'm here doing stupid layouts, you know, but it was the best thing for my health that was possible. And I think what comes to mind for me technically is always like, you know, ears covered, tapping at the right time and then doing candlestick drops. Are there other things that you're trying to really focus on with young athletes? Like I think you mentioned, you know, like really feeling the beat of the bar, but technically are there other things besides ears covered and, you know, tapping well? Are there other pieces there?
So I feel like for the flyaway dismount, it's about pushing on the bar as well. So you feel the support when you're in the handstand. Once you get your toes down, when you don't just relax and arch through your back, you need to then push the bar forwards. By pushing the bar forwards and loading the bar that way, it creates the reaction the other way, bends the bar the opposite way. And then as you release, it takes you up and away in front.
Right.
Whereas if you just swing around the bar, kind of like a long swing, you are creating rotation. But you get one of those flyaways that is almost like pings off the bar and rotates really fast around to your back. Whereas if you can push the bar, you almost stop your rotation and your straight back, your candlestick will almost stop in the air upside down and then really slowly just kind of flop around onto your feet. And then it's dead easy to stick the landing to that.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. And I think another thing I see that's really successful in the most elite athletes is they have those basics from a very young age. And it's always like part of their daily routine to do it over and over. And I remember I had a teammate in university who was a phenomenal high bar worker, but every turn, this guy was doing the craziest stuff ever. He would go swing half turn, tap, tap, double back. And the fact that he could do a high floaty double back above the bar from a tap swing means like you're saying, the bar mechanics, he understands where to bend, he understands angles, and he would just do it on a whim every day, you know, very casually. Yeah. And I feel like tap, tap, double back in my mind is just like the essence of great bar, like high bar technique, you know?
Yeah, for sure. My guys do similar in that every day their turns and swinging circuit that they do at the start of their session will finish with a straight back or a layout dismount. Not because they can't double straight or double, but because it really reinforces how they push on the bar and how they stop the rotation. And they've got just complete control over it. And they always, they play around, they'll fly away, they'll do their layaway and they'll clap behind their back and in front of their body and see how many claps they can do before they land. But yeah, it's just the reinforcement of how to push the bar and how to fly away.
Yeah. And I love that kind of piece too, which is if you learn the fundamentals really well and you stick to them, is that it does become more of an enjoyable, fun playing experience, not this like, oh my God, this bar is so terrifying. Right. And I feel like that's the foundation you have to create with young coaches, right? You have to be able to teach the skill sets and there's a cultural piece there to going slow and really hammering the basics and not being, you know, making it fun in a way. Cause let's be real, 10-year-old boys do not want to do swing half turns for the rest of their life.
Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, there's absolutely like they have a balance between the fundamentals and the skills. Everybody likes learning the skills, but the skills come so much easier and they're so much less scary when your fundamentals and your basics are solid.
Right. And I think the other thing that comes up to me, I hear a lot of coaches be not frustrated with, but hard with is High bar in particular is there's just microseconds of tapping mechanics that separate good versus bad. And then for me, for example, I know my ceiling effect is when I was learning Takachev and double dismounts at the same time. So a Chinese tap at the same time I was learning a Takachev tap. Yeah. And I put a couple Takachevs to my back and I put a couple dismounts really far. And for me, I could never quite get over that hurdle. And so can you maybe speak to the difference between technical pieces for dismount taps versus maybe like, you know, setting up release move taps? I think that's a hard line for people to jump across.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I kind of in my lecture, I touch on, you can do different entries to a catch-up as well. So you can have the wind up that's similar to a dismount, but you can also do it from like a bounce and handstand and just a push out. So right. I think to start with, it's quite nice to differentiate the two. If you do like a Chinese tap into your dismount, perhaps when you start learning the catch-up to start it from the bounce position, just to differentiate. And, you know, once they start to get a bit of an understanding of that, then you can increase, you can introduce the Chinese tap swing across the bar so that they do push out early.
Mm. And with that too, I think an error that I made and then others might make is giants into a release right away. Whereas I feel like the greatest coaches I've watched will do, like we said, tap swings into a dismount, but also will do Takachevs from a tap swing, right? We'll do strap bar, loads of metal bar, loads of metal bar. But then their first release is back up rise to 45 maybe in that aggressive tap. And they get over the bar, not with brute force of swing, but with technical bouncing. You just slide the mat in 1,000 times so nobody gets hurt. But you could do reps and reps and reps of tap swing Takachev versus like giants and tapping is a lot more brutal on your body, you know?
Absolutely. And also you think when you go from a giant or a long swing, essentially what you're doing is you're increasing the speed. And by increasing the speed, you are making it harder to hit that exact tiny point of the timing that you need to hit to make your release correct. You imagine like you're spinning a dartboard around you. You've got to try and hit the the triple 20. The faster you spin that dartboard, the harder it is to hit your triple 20. So, you know, by doing it from a nice, calm, slow tap swing, you're really, really just slowing it all down, making it more clear for the exact angle and the timing that you need to hit. And once you're consistent and solid and you've got that locked in, then you add the speed and then you can hit that triple 20 from whatever speed you're spinning.
I love that analogy. That's really good. And it leads me to ask, so in the process of learning, you know, these skills, these releases, what percentage of your coaching time and how long is it on just drills and just metal bar and just the basics versus when you start letting someone actually throw and release, you know, what's that percentage for you of like drill time versus actual skill time?
I would say I don't believe in doing drills for the sake of doing drills, because there's nothing that substitutes the actual gymnastic,
right?
You know, for actually doing it. But having said that, you need to. There'd be certain key coaching points that I feel that they need to achieve before allowing them to do the skill. As soon as they're able to hit those points, I would let them do the skill. But then, you know, I think it's important to have the whole image, the broader picture, as well, and then, you know, rein it back in and focus on an area that where there's something missing or something that's going slightly wrong. Take it back, focus a specific prep on or drill on a certain area, and then try to put it back into the whole setting again. Maybe around sort of 50-50, but it's forwards and back. It's never just drills, skills. It's always, right, you know, a couple of drills, try the skills, see what's wrong, a couple of drills to fix or to try to make a change to and back into the skills.
Yeah. And I really love kind of this idea you're talking about, which is going between, I guess it's more of like a critical thinking approach to skill breakdown. I think I see a lot of gyms and a lot of young, you know, it's busy, right? There's a lot of guys, you're running around. They just set up 10 drills, they go in a circuit, and then one person is being spotted or watched on the actual bar, which there's a time and a place for that and like volume. But what you're seeing, what I hear a lot of coaches say is like setting up some sort of circuit where you can do one, watch a video, get some critical feedback, and then go do a drill if it's not working, do a few drills, get back on the bar, and kind of critically think about why is it not going well or why is it going well, and what do I need technically to fix? Am I wrong there, or is that accurate?
No, that's exactly right. And it's about doing, like you say, a specific drill. It's not about doing, you know, I could think of 50 or 100 drills that are relevant to doing a catch-up on bar, but I wouldn't get my gymnast to do all of those drills at, you know, at any one time. you need to, but for me, it's about being smart about where you're spending your time and focusing on the area that you want improved, the change that you're trying to bring about, and find a suitable drill or exercise to do that. Not just do this drill because I've seen someone do it, that one because I saw it on Instagram, this one was one of my favorites on YouTube, and we'll put all of those together and just hope that we get a good catch up at the end of it. But I mean, yeah, you know, so they're not going to be wrong. I'm not saying the drills will be wrong, they will be relevant, but it's not necessarily correcting your gymnastic fault.
Right. Something I learned from Nick that really fundamentally changed the way I view coaching and stuff like that is kind of his idea of like Kodak moments or key positions you're looking for within the actual drill or skill. And I feel like that's maybe where the opportunity lies, which is like, if you know what a great, you know, Takachev tap looks like, you want to be able to see those pieces replicated. And then if it's not replicated on video or your coaching eye, you can pull back to a drill, which maybe replicates what they're trying to connect those dots on. I've found that that's a way more, constructive and efficient use of time versus what you're saying, which is like the just pray that a bunch of these drills just magically show up in the skill, you know?
Yeah, for sure. No, I love that. The Kodak moment, that's really cool. That's good to hear from that as well. But yeah, definitely, that's exactly what it is. And I think it's important for the gymnast to know and to understand exactly what they're trying to achieve as well. Particularly you're older and you're more elite gymnast. And to figure out how best they like that information as well. Do they like to look at it in a video? Do they like to feel it or put into the shape?
Right.
It's important as well because, you know, people learn in different ways and they have different preferences in how they best take in and understand information also. So, you know, to make sure the two of you are singing from the same hymn sheet, really.
Sure. That's such a great call out too, right? There's one gymnast who has to watch somebody else do it. Maybe you look at a video of YouTube, right? Or another gymnast doing it in the club versus somebody else is going to have to, like, you tell them specifically the technical points out loud versus somebody else has to do a drill and get spotted to feel what that feels like. There's so many different learning styles. And I feel like that's a really important thing you said there.
For sure. And also, as well as learning style, one of my other philosophies that I'm quite big on is, utilizing gymnast natural strengths or their preference as well, because you know one gymnast body type is going to be different to another. Their strength or their confidence is going to be different, so both in terms of which skills we select for those gymnasts to do and also which technique of that skill do we teach them, because you know you can do a catch-up in different ways. Just because one gymnast does a catch-up from a tap swing, it doesn't mean another gymnast from just a push out. So just to bear that in mind also.
Yeah. And that brings up a good point with body type is I'm curious your thoughts on, you know, we're talking about the Takachevs here, but if somebody maybe is a really tall athlete, right? Or if somebody is a little bit more faster twitch athlete, do you think like based on the strengths of the athlete, we'll have one do a Ginger versus Takachev versus learn a Kovacs, or is it just like whatever naturally comes to them? Like, how do you differentiate between what lane someone goes down for?
Yeah, I think you can definitely look at body type. That's generally a good indication. But, you just get sometimes you get some gymnasts that really struggle with a twist. So you wouldn't try to do, a big twist in vault with them. If they're more of a powerful, dynamic gymnast, they might be more suited to a double somersault vault. And similar things on high bar, really. If you've got someone who has, really stiff shoulders, you wouldn't try to teach them a jam to handstand. So you might go down the quast or the Rabalco route. But yeah, and also for confidence as well, if you've got a real daredevil gymnast, they love the challenge, they love, you know, trying new skills, then Kovacs is great. We'll do Kovacs. But, you know, another gymnast who you know is very, very nervous and introverted and, you know, they don't like the big shouting and cheering and, you know, they're more like, okay, we'll just take it easy and do a little bit more of a potentially less scary release.
Yeah, I absolutely love that, man. You couldn't have paid me enough money to do a Kovacs, like not in a million years. There's no way. So I was on that other spot of the spectrum, which is like a little bit less risk-taking reserve. You know what I mean? That was more for me.
Absolutely, yeah. And you can get a fantastic high bar routine that doesn't have a Kovacs in it. You don't have to have a Kovacs. You know, you might be more of an in bar and a jam to handstand and turns and that sort of skills. But this is my point in, working with your gymnast strengths. Don't just try to teach everybody a Kovacs because today's session's on Kovacs.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great call out. I think the other thing that comes to mind is that idea of drills and skills, but then where as a coach are you feeling comfortable to put something in a routine? Like, do you have to see this be mastery on its own before it's put in a half set? Do you want to see someone's endurance get up? Like, what's the thought process? I feel like going from catching your first Tkachev to competing Tkachev in a routine is like light years away for some people.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Definitely. I am a big believer in combining things as early as possible. So, you know, at the earliest stage, it's as soon as you catch your first catcher, don't just giant and drop off. You know, giant to a blind turn and then try an endo. And, you know, it doesn't have to be always afterwards to start with, because obviously, you know, the skill that you're focusing on learning, you're going to do almost as if it were in isolation. But then when you do catch it, you carry on. And then it gets to the point where, you know, we're catching fairly consistently, maybe, you know, 3 out of 5, 4 out of 5. We can start to try to maybe do a skill beforehand. We'll do a back upright before we do a catch up and, you know, just gradually do that. But I think the earlier you can do that and the more quickly you can get away with doing skills completely in isolation, you know, it just builds an easier base to create your routine from and to move it on to the next level.
Yeah, I totally love that, right? And the idea of taking something that maybe for this athlete, they learned an endo when they were 10, right? And then they're doing endos no problem, but it's a very fluid skill. But now they're adding that in, maybe like endo before, Tkachev, something else on the other side, or the other way around, which is, you know, do your Tkachev first, then a bunch of skills after to a light dismount. I feel like, again, having to do that in isolation versus quickly find that tap in that position really fast is probably a really important skill set.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, it's all about it, just quickens their thinking. And they just become more prepared for all the different eventualities. You know, as soon as they catch, somebody's there shouting, "Come on, carry on, do a endo, do a disc." And you know, it's really important for me that, you know, don't try to move away from isolation as quick as you can.
Sure. I love that. And then on the other piece of it too, which comes to mind, is I know a lot of coaches ask me, and I see a lot of guys for, you know, either like physical prep issues where they're not quite strong enough to bounce the bar hard enough or things like that. Are there like some staples that you can recommend for either physical preparation or other things you do prior to, you know, introducing release moves or dismounts and stuff to help somebody get strong enough to, you know, move the bar well?
I think moving the bar is quite a difficult one because it comes with a little bit with size and weight as well.
Yeah, right.
If you've got an 8-year-old gymnast and they're very slim built, you know, the type, you know, they can do
it. Things not moving at all.
That thing is not moving. But and there's little tricks you can do. I mean, you can loosen the bar a little bit, obviously not so it's too loose, but, you know, loosen it off a little bit just so there's a little bit more flexibility. I quite like the idea of just static handstand bounces, you know, holding the gymnast by their feet whilst they're on a floor bar. Keeping them in good body tension and bouncing. But I would do this on a wooden girls bar because the bounce and the give of that bar is a lot more than you would get on a men's bar. But you can create the same kind of feeling in the same way that you use a soft springboard for a younger gymnast. You wouldn't go straight onto a hard 7 springboard because they're not going to move that. But, you know, there's a certain amount of, you know, they have to have a little bit of size and weight to do that. But as long as you're reinforcing the key position, lots of backward rolls to handstand, you know, finishing and bouncing in handstand, they'll quite quickly get to the point where they start to feel what they need to do. But I think it's really important to learn that at a young age, because as they grow, that phenomenon will develop with them and they will maintain that. And yes, it does change as they get bigger, but it changes with them rather than.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like in those younger years, 8, 9, 10, 11, right, when someone's not gone through fully development, that's when you really can master and hone on that technical piece. Because if they hone in the technical piece, they really understand the pieces, they can move the bar well. And then you add, you know, strength and you add puberty and stuff, they get, you know, 5-10 pounds of muscle mass on top of them. Those foundations are still in place versus the opposite, which is, you know, you don't really develop the technical stuff. You add mass and power, and then that technical piece gets exaggerated and it gets a lot more intimidating, right? Because you don't have that building block first and you add speed on top of that, to your point with the dartboard. It's like, now it's really intimidating, no?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it kind of goes back to what we touched on earlier in that, you know, you reinforce that technical stuff first,
You get your timings, you get your understanding of your key coaching points, your bounce, your support through the bar. Then as soon as you get the extra weight and the power behind you, like say you had a factor in puberty, you've got this extra 10 kilos of muscle that you're ready to blast the bar with. And that just goes like, it just makes it absolutely so much better.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, this is probably a great place just to kind of transition and end here. I don't want to give away too much of your wonderful lecture coming. I got a sneak peek, so I know it's really good. But can you maybe share about like what are some of the key pieces that will be in the lecture that you're excited to share with everybody on, you know, releases specifically?
Yeah, so we look at two releases. We look at the Katchev and the Kovach, which in my opinion are the kind of the big releases at the moment. The in moves, particularly since the code has changed that you can't only have two or three releases per group. It becomes really, really important now that a gymnast can do two different families of release. Mm-hmm. And I think these are the two highest, lead to the two highest value kind of branches of releases to help really create an exciting and current bar routine moving forward.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm excited to have people, because I think you do a great job of like the philosophy of the big picture stuff, but there's also so many great drills, progressions that are inside there. I feel like most coaches want both, right? You want to understand the big picture, but then like, okay, what drills, what things am I looking for? What ideas are really important that, you know, someone can take to the gym the next day?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, hopefully there's a few new drills in there. You know, there's some that I've come up with myself that I haven't actually, you know, just kind of gone out and sort of seen and brought back, but kind of a few that I've engineered and created myself. So hopefully they'll be a kind of fresh for the people to look at and see. But yeah, definitely it's about, like say, the big picture, how to fit it in, when to teach a release, and kind of like the bigger athlete picture also, skill selection and technique selection as well.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be awesome. And I don't want to spoil too much, so I'll keep my mouth shut right there. But Will, man, I appreciate your time. I know you're very busy. You're in the gym. You probably got to go run and coach right now. But I appreciate you being here. And then we're looking forward to seeing you in the symposium. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Dave. No, it's been a pleasure. Really great to meet you as well.
All right. We'll talk soon. All right.
Cool. Thank you, brother. Take care. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to that episode. I hope that you really enjoyed it and got a lot of value out of it. I just want to let you know before we sign off here that a couple things we'd love you to do. So one is please just make sure that you rate and review the podcast on iTunes or Spotify or Stitcher, wherever you're listening, because that really does help the episode grow quite a bit. And then second, if you really enjoyed this episode, we would love if you left us a review as well and told us what you liked about it. You know, what information was useful, what things were not useful, would you like to know more about, what guests you want to have on in the future. And then also as you kind of go about your day, if you found something really useful, just toss it up on social media. We love to hear from people on Instagram or Twitter or, you know, all the different websites that they're using for social media. Facebook is great too. But yeah, let us know what you like, because honestly, the podcast comes from people who just tell us what they're finding useful. And that's how we create the next set of content. So yeah, tag us in the podcast or tag us online, whatever you're doing, and let us know what you think. Thanks.